This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
And I want to thank everyone that's gathered here today. Thank you for being here.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand launched her presidential campaign outside the Trump Hotel in Manhattan, attacking the president in front of one of his gold-lettered buildings. It's not a bad way to get some attention.
Our president is a coward. And that is not what we deserve. That is not what you deserve.
Gillibrand is not so well known outside of New York. She represented a congressional district upstate, and she came to the Senate in 2009, filling Hillary Clinton's former seat. Ever since, she's been fierce on the cause of sexual assault and harassment and a champion of the Me Too movement. She was one of the first to call on Senator Al Franken to step down. And some in her party, she says, are still absolutely furious with her over it. In other ways, Gillibrand's policies have, let's say, evolved. Her A rating from the NRA some years back is now a solid F. And like other centrist Democrats in the race, she's taking pains to emphasize her support for progressive policies like Medicare for All. I reached Kirsten Gillibrand in Washington last week. Senator, we now know that Robert Mueller was not exactly thrilled by the handling of his report by the Attorney General. And he felt that he had been, if we can summarize it, distorted at best. What do you feel about it? And how do you now feel about the case for impeachment?
Well, I am deeply concerned, and I've been concerned with how Attorney General Barr handled the Mueller report overall. You have to remember, the first thing he did that he shouldn't have done is issue the four-page summary. And that's what Mueller responded to, saying, your summary did not represent our conclusions. The second thing that Barr did was he held that press conference where he again reframed what the Mueller report said. And then third, he then produced finally the Mueller report in a highly redacted form. So I think the way Attorney General Barr has handled himself now that we have this letter that Mueller sent to Barr, and we have Barr's testimony after he received that letter saying, oh, he didn't know what Mueller thought of his summary, I think he himself acted inappropriately. And I actually don't see how he can lead the department. And I believe he should resign.
You believe he should resign?
I do. I think he has intentionally misled the public. And for him to go to Congress and say, I don't know what Mueller thinks of my summary, I think is an outright lie. I don't think you can have an attorney general who has purposely misled Congress.
Now, how is this making you feel about impeachment in general? Because you've cut a fine line so far.
I'm not against impeachment. I just believe there should be a process. And I don't think the American people have had an opportunity to read the Mueller report. I think the facts that are in that report need to be elucidated through hearings so that the American people can follow along and fully understand what facts Mueller found and what this president actually did that would support an obstruction of justice indictment or an obstruction of justice-based impeachment proceeding. But I can tell you, I have been traveling across the country, and people are not asking about the Mueller report. They believe that Washington is broken. They believe there's enormous political corruption. They think that the powerful decide everything in Washington and the moneyed interests decide everything. They believe the special interests get their way no matter what. They look at the Koch brothers. They see that they can spend $300 million in an election just for a lower tax rate, and they get what they pay for. And so the truth is, I'm running on publicly funded elections because the problem is bigger than just the allegations against President Trump for obstruction of justice. The problem is deep-seated. It's been in place for a very long time. And we need transparency and accountability that takes on the entire political infrastructure. That's why I issued legislation yesterday to talk about how we have publicly funded elections, how we actually get money out of politics and restore the power to the hands of the people.
Senator, millions of voters who had voted for Barack Obama then turned around and voted for Donald Trump. How do you connect with those people? And what is your sense as somebody from upstate New York, where a lot of those voters were, why did they do that and how can they be brought back in?
Easily. And they are brought back in by listening and understanding their concerns. I just won back 18 counties in New York that Trump won. I won it back by going to all 62 counties and doing 18 town halls. I didn't spend money on television. I just listened and actually responded by helping those communities. What they're worried about is healthcare. They are so worried that their children will not have access to the medicine they need or the life-saving care they need or the treatment they need because some insurance company doesn't want to cover them because they have a pre-existing condition. They're worried about the education system. They are fearful that their local public school is crumbling, doesn't have the support that they need, and isn't going to give a chance to their kid to have any part of the American dream. They're worried about themselves. Our unemployment rate may well be 4%, but I can tell you the underemployment rate is skyrocketing. People do not make enough money to meet the needs of their families, period. And that's why I'm running on dealing with underemployment, unemployment, with job training, working with the employers to develop the coursework and apprenticeship programs, using the community colleges and state schools to actually train for the jobs in your region that pay higher than what you're earning right now.
Is there a world in which all this legislation that you're talking about can get through a Congress that is really characterized by, in the Senate, Mitch McConnell?
Yes. So despite Mitch McConnell, I passed 18 bills in the last Congress. The way I did that was I found common ground with Republican colleagues and built from there. Getting a Republican member of Congress to help you with rural broadband isn't that hard. That's something that helps lots of states that have rural areas. I passed a piece of legislation for Made in America manufacturing. I could find Republicans who wanted to do that with me. And so, you know, a lot of people in our party, they're at the edges. They go to their corners, and that doesn't work. You need to find the common ground. And it doesn't mean compromising. It means creating a vision that's bold and robust that you can find people to sign on to. When we repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we didn't say, well, only some people in the gay community are going to be protected. We said, no, this is about making sure the men and women who serve in our country can actually serve and not be denied based on who they love. That if they're willing to die for this country, why would you make it impossible? And the argument that worked for my Republican colleagues might well have been different. It was, why would you lose 1,000 people in mission critical areas? Why would you deny the ability of people to serve based on who they love?
Senator, you came to prominence in no small measure because of your vocal support for what became the Me Too movement. And you were very critical of Al Franken, and you were the first to come forward and say that he should resign. Now you are in a presidential race and you are facing, among others, Joe Biden. And a lot of women have come forward and said that he made them feel uncomfortable. Is Joe Biden's past behavior disqualifying in your view?
I don't think it's disqualifying, but it's certainly something he's going to have to talk about. Women are going to want to ask him how he feels about this. And that's his job. My job is to talk about my vision for this country, how I'm going to pass a Green New Deal, how I'm going to pass Medicare for All, how I'm going to pass the job training we need to get more people into the middle class.
To another subject, which is, I understand, but do you find his explanations and his comments about this satisfying to you?
I personally don't.
And so do you think that he's qualified to be a presidential candidate in light of that?
I believe he is qualified, but I also believe this is something he's going to have to talk about. The Me Too movement is part of a much broader conversation. Me Too was about sexual harassment and sexual assault specifically. What we started after President Trump got elected was a women's movement across the globe. Women started marching to be heard, to have the ability to share their truth, whatever it was. What was so powerful about the march was that women marched on all issues they cared about. Their signs could have said Black Lives Matter or women's reproductive freedom or clean air and clean water or LGBTQ equality. It didn't matter. It just mattered that they wanted to be heard. And that activism has not stopped. And so if you don't understand what's actually happening and you are dismissing the voices and the views and the values of women, you will not catch fire in this election and you will not be our nominee. And you are not the best person to take on President Trump. I believe I'm the best person to take on President Trump because I do take on the fights no one else will take on. And not only that, I'm successful in those fights. I actually get things done. I move the needle forward on women's rights, on gay rights, on clean air and clean water, on manufacturing, on jobs, on the economy. And I have a track record of doing really bold things on a bipartisan basis, things that were left for dead that no one could pass. I was able to move the needle. 9/11 health bill sat dormant for 7 years. No one had moved it. It had 20 hearings in the House and was going nowhere. It had never been introduced in the Senate, not even a hearing. I took that bill from 0 to 100 within one term as a freshman senator. That means you need to reach across the aisle. You need to find the common ground. You need to lift up people's voices who aren't being heard, and you need to fight for them. Whether you're an inner city or a rural red area, they are suffering and they need someone to care.
You're in a complicated race. 20 people are in this race of all kinds, which is in some ways an incredibly healthy thing for the Democratic Party, and it's unpredictable as well. Let's skip to the part where you're the nominee and you're facing Donald Trump in a race and on a debate stage and all the rest. He has proved himself to be willing to say and do practically anything about his opponent. And oftentimes, it's incredibly effective, like it or not. How do you oppose that? How do you run against that? How much do you deflect and how much do you take on directly?
So my story is a bit different than other people who are running. My first two opponents were in a 2-to-1 Republican district who demeaned me and name-called me and tried to dismiss me. And not only did it make my candidacy relevant, but it made a lot of people deeply offended. And they wanted to know who I was and why was I running and why is he hitting her that way? Why is he saying those things about her? I don't think it works. I believe that for President Trump, his Achilles heel is a mother with young children who's running on issues that people care about and that families care about. I think his kryptonite is a woman who stands up for what she believes in and doesn't back down. I don't believe he will be effective against me because I will dismiss him in the way I would anybody who is acting like a child would, acting like a child who is spoiled and wants their way no matter what. And if he starts to name call or he starts to glower over me in a debate, I will say, please go back to your place. Your spot is over there. It's my turn to talk now, and you will wait your turn, because that's how I would handle an irreverent child who is being a bully. Like, you don't punch a bully in the face. It actually doesn't work. You know, if you want to get in a fight with a pig and you want to get into the mud with a pig, the pig has fun and you get dirty and no one looks good.
Senator, I'm grateful for your time and I wish you well on the campaign trail. Thank you so much.
Oh, God bless. Take care.
Take care. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. I spoke with her last week. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and still to come, I'll talk with the singer Rhiannon Giddens. And we'll go to church, more than one church, actually, with the comedian Pete Holmes, whose new book is about comedy and spirituality. That's all ahead. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Can I have your C?
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
And the banjo tuned to the accordion the beginning of a joke? Some sort.
Rhiannon Giddens has had one of the more unusual career paths of any musician I know. She studied opera at the Oberlin Conservatory, one of the more prestigious music programs in the country, and she trained there to be a soprano.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger.
But almost by chance, she fell hard and deep into the study of American folk music. She became the front woman of a string band called the Carolina Chocolate Drops and focused on reviving forgotten musical traditions of the Black diaspora. Now, as a solo artist, she's moved increasingly far afield. Her new album explores folk styles from the Middle Eastern and European, as well as the early American traditions. She's made the record in collaboration with the musician Francesco Turisi, and it's called There Is No Other. Rhiannon, I have to tell you that I think it was 6 years ago already, 6 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
That there was this amazing night at Town Hall in New York that was put on as a kind of promotion and concert for Inside Llewellyn Davis, which was about the folk scene of the late 50s and 60s. And it was a pretty good lineup.
You're telling me.
Joan Baez, so many people. And you got up and brought the house down and brought the house to its feet. Tell me about that night, what you sang and what that was like, killing like that.
Well, it was a really interesting experience because in T-Bone, asked me to do it, you know.
This is T-Bone Burnett who produced the album and all the music for the film.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't done a lot of solo stuff at that point because I'd just really been doing the Chocolate Drops. And, you know, it was not with my band. It was, you know, it was all very instinctual. I was just like, I just wanted to not screw up. I don't know. I was kind of so shocked by the response to it, you know, that the following days, the write-ups, I had no idea it was such a big deal. It was literally like ghosting the song and don't screw it up, you know. And
did it change your career? Did it change your life in any way that night?
It did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's how my next two collaborations were with T-Bone, and that they totally came out of that night. My solo record, Tomorrow's My Turn, I had no intention of going solo anytime. You know, soon I was like really focused on the Chocolate Drops and was very excited about it. And then it was kind of like, well, you know, when T-Bone Burnett says, let's do a solo record, you don't go, can you come back in a couple of years? You just go, yes, you know.
Now, your records are often categorized as something called Americana, which is a term that you hear a lot, and it gets stuck on folk music, all various kinds of music. Do you embrace it? Do you reject it? And what does it mean to you?
I have a complicated relationship with Americana as a term. I have a complicated relationship with genres. I hate them, number one.
You just want it to be called music.
I just want it to be called music, or even American music's fine. You know, acoustic music. Now, Americana, I understand what they're trying to do. You know, commercial country kind of has gone down this certain road, and they're trying to create a space for the singer-songwriter, for the story song. You know, I get all that. I still feel like, you know, you make a genre, you tend to narrow into it.
Now, you're on your third solo album, and you've got a new collaborator who's sitting here with us, Francesco Terisi. Tell me about your musical relationship and how this came to become an album.
Well, yeah, I guess it's kind of, it was just one of those kind of magical things. Do you want to say how?
I got in touch first with Rhiannon about 4 years ago. I knew about the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and I'd heard some of the music. I was doing a lot of research at the time in the early history of jazz, and I thought it was a very interesting take.
Scholarly research.
Well, I was lecturing history of jazz. I mean, we're both kind of musicians who have a lot of interest in research, so I don't know if I would call myself a scholar, but we read a lot of books, put it that way. So I just thought it was a very interesting missing link that nobody talks about, the Black String Band in the history of early jazz. And
well, tell us about that. What is the missing link, and describe what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm the right person to talk about this, but the way I saw it was just that, you know, because I was actually teaching history of jazz in a BA course in Dublin, which is where I live. We both live in Ireland. And just reading all the classic literature on the early history of jazz, everybody focuses very much on the brass bands and the importance of that kind of in New Orleans and the development of early jazz. And the string bands are never really mentioned in that transition between ragtime and early jazz. And they were obviously a big part of it all. Maybe you should say something about
right.
that because yeah, that's your
fill
corner.
Fill us in. What are we ignoring? What are we missing?
Well, the string band and the black string band in particular, you know, it really is at the heart of so many, here we go with genres again, the genres of American music. And it was a widespread phenomenon, you know, that goes back to the time of slavery when black people were seen as natural musicians. They were encouraged to pick up instruments and then play for white people's dances and frolics and parties. And so you have the combination of, you know, native rhythms and modes from West Africa, from all over where people were coming from, and instruments that were coming over, like the banjo, which grew out of West African lute-type instruments. I mean,
how much of this do we have recorded?
It's huge. Not any. That's the problem.
So how are you excavating the music in a way?
With dots. You know, with the sheet music.
That must give you a very wide berth on how to play it.
Well, the thing is like there's a lot of scholarship that's been done on these early banjo tutors. They were very, very clear in how to play this instrument. And this,
you keep saying this instrument. We have one on the floor
here. Sorry.
Can you describe what this is? Because it's obviously not the kind of thing that you'd see Earl Scruggs play or.
Yeah, the banjo that I have is a replica of, well, it's kind of a composite of some banjos from the late 1850s. It's a wooden banjo. See, the early minstrel style banjos were all fretless. People are always surprised by this because it's fretless and they were gut string. And that's because they were that one step removed from the homemade gourd instruments that black folk would have been making on plantations or wherever. And that was the banjo first. And so they were all be playing these kind of instruments, which are wooden hoop, wooden you know, wooden fretboard, fretless, you know, and it's just a deeper, more resonant sort of round, warm sound.
And Francesca, you're playing a drum that is called a...
Duff.
A duff.
It's a drum that comes from Iran. It's a large frame drum that has got a particularity that has got little iron rings hanging. And they could kind of, by shaking the drum, you hit the skin and they create a really washy type
of
sound.
Give it a little... So these many dozens of rings that are on the inside lip of the drum, that's what makes that kind of haunted
sound. Yeah, so it's a drum that you find in Iran and in other countries in Central Asia, used in folk music, but it's also an instrument used by Sufi brotherhoods, and they use it for trance dancing, you know? So this kind of washy sound very often you find in cultures related to trance, you know?
And what you're going to play, is, I understand, is a kind of ghost story in a song called Little Margaret.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
That was actually one of the earliest things that we connected on, this idea of the drum, the frame drum in across the ocean, Middle East and in North Africa and the Mediterranean being a drum that's supposed to be played with a singer. You know, because it's got a tone to it. And so we were looking for that connection. And I thought, well, Appalachian ballads, like they also have that trance feel as well. And so it just worked so beautifully. Little Margaret is I learned from Sheila K. Adams from Western North Carolina. And it goes all the way back to, you know, some English ballad from centuries ago.
We don't know who wrote it.
It's old. It's really old, like 14th century. I mean, it's like old. It goes back. But this is an Appalachian version. And it's basically the story of a young woman who was in love with a man. And he goes out, starts, you know, seeing somebody else. Later that night, she appears to him at his bedside. And he sees her and realizes that it's her that he wants. And so he goes to visit her, and then he finds out that she's died. And in the song, the imagery is basically that her appearing in white means that she's a ghost, even though he doesn't realize that. And then when he goes to her father's and she's in her cold black coffin with her face turned toward the wall, her face turned toward the wall meant that she was a suicide. And then at the end, when he falls into her arms, that means he dies. Like, so these are all kind of... imagery that were used in lots of different ballads to sort of denote these things without actually coming out and saying them.
Spooky stuff.
Spooky stuff, yeah.
So I'd love to hear it.
Well, let's do it.
Little Margaret sitting in her high-hole chair, combing back her long yellow hair. Saw sweet William and his new maid bride riding up the road so near. She threw down her ivory comb, threw back her long yellow hair, said, I'll go down and I'll bid him farewell and I'll never more go there. It was late in the night, they were fast asleep. Little Margaret appeared all dressed in white, standing at their bed feet, saying, how do you like your snow white pillow? How do you like your sheet? Saying, how do you like that pretty fair maid who lays in your arms asleep? Very well do I like my snow white pillow. Well do I like my sheet. Much better do I like that pretty fair maid who stands at my bed feet. He called a serving man to go saddle the dappled roan. And he rode for her father's house that night, knocked on the door alone, saying, is little Margaret in her room or is she in the hall? Little Margaret's in her cold black coffin with her face turned toward the wall. Unfold, unfold those snow-white robes, be they ever so fine, for for I want to kiss those cold, cold lips, for I know they'll never kiss mine. 3 times he kissed her cold, cold hand, twice he kissed her cheek, and once he kissed her cold, cold lips, and he fell in her arms. Asleep.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. And you, what, how much of this song was given to you and how much of it is yours in terms of its invention or melody?
I mean, that's, you know, it was originally an Appalachian ballad, like unaccompanied. So it's, I'm singing it just like that. What I'm doing is when we first started playing it, I just sort of, instead of just going through the song, you know, with no pauses in between the lines, there were moments where the drum kind of, I would slow the action down a little bit, and then when it speeds up again, so that definitely came from me just kind of reacting to what he was playing, you know.
Renan, you went to Oberlin, you studied, you had formal mm-hmm. training there,
yeah.
doing a lot of
opera. Mm-hmm.
How did you become you? How did you kind of create yourself and your sense of direction and where you would go in music coming out of a place like Oberlin where you had had this formal training?
Did you
think you were going to be singing Les Somnambula or being an opera singer?
We all do coming out of conservatory.
Right.
We're going to be the next big soprano, you know?
What happened?
I discovered folk music and I discovered the banjo. And I also, you know, I'm very interested in doing something that is A, of service, and B, that not everybody else is doing. So I was like, gosh, there's like a million sopranos in the world who can sing as good or much better than I can,
yeah.
who can do these things and want to devote their life to opera, where I'm seeing this other thing, and I'm like, this is something I think I can make a difference in, you know? And it touches me, and it speaks to me. And so it for me, it goes to show that you have to find the thing that you are meant to do, you know? And you don't know what it is always, but if you follow the thing that's speaking to you, you just don't know where it's going to lead you.
Well,
you know?
I hate to pound on this notion of categories, but what you just sang, is that classical music in a sense?
No. I mean, but then what, I mean...
That's what I mean.
You know, what is classical music, you know? I mean, we do on the album 2 arias, you know, but we do them in vernacular voice and with a sort of improv accompaniment, and it's like, they live in a different realm and they touch people in a different way, but they're, you know, does it still mean that they're not an aria anymore? I mean, you know, I mean, that's kind of also the point of the record is, you know, who cares what the, and it, this is not just smashing stuff together. Like, that's important to mention. It's not like, you know, I mention our similar approaches because I think that's why our layers kind of work, you know, because we're layering things on top of each other and finding where the peaks, because there's all of these similarities between all of these different things, and
right.
and it leads us to, you know, what music is doing for us as humanity, you know, because somebody was saying, well, you know, our diversity is also our strength. You're saying that we're all the same. I'm like, well, in our differences, we're the same.
Yeah.
That's the point, is that, you know, we express ourselves in different ways, but it's all coming back to these universal truths as humans, and the more that we can reject that idea that you are over there and you sound different to me, so that we're different people, and embrace that actually what I do in my culture and what you do in your culture is coming from the same heart, and therefore they should be able to work together. You know, that's more of what we're trying to say.
How does that relate to the next song that I think you're going to do? And you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation to get it exactly right.
Yes.
Pizzica di San Vito.
That's pretty good.
And means?
Pizzica is a type of dance from Puglia, which is a
southern
Apulian
Italy.
Region,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it's a type of tarantella, which is a very lively, I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea of that. But the particular thing about this music that a lot of people don't know about is that it was music to cure the bite of a spider. And it was, no, this is a very serious thing, actually. The idea with the pizzica is that you got bitten. They believed in the bite of the spider, tarantula, that's why it's called tarantella. And you would fall into a state of depression. And the only way to get rid of this was to trance dance, which could go on sometimes for weeks. You know, the musicians would come to your house.
So it's pre-antibiotics.
Definitely pre-antibiotic. Mind you, this was the last time observed in its full power in the 1960s. 1960s was still happening in Puglia.
Incredible. How is that tuned? How is it tuned?
C, well, right now it's in modal. But I have like three different tunings I use. Non c'è da venire, non c'è da venire, non c'è da venire, sono venuto. Solisse spirito, solisse spirito, m'hanno chiamato. Aueli, mulo vecchio ti veni, mulo vecchio t'inchinami dalla mano si ne va. Aueli, mulo vecchio ti veni, mulo vecchio t'inchinami dalla mano si ne va. Ti li capelli tutto innamorato, li becco ti volà, li becco ti volà, li becco ti volà, talo viento. Occhi co, dici perdi l'occhi, ci dici male nuestro scatallo cuori. Occhi co, dici perdi l'occhi, ci dici male nuestro scatallo cuori.
Think of as your audience for music like this, or do you not think of it? Is it not worth thinking about?
I mean, you just can't. You can't think about audiences. You know, you just. I mean, that's.
Who do you see in the seats?
Well, I mean, it depends on where we are. I mean, we haven't actually really started touring this yet, but you know, it depends on who knows about it. I mean, this is the sort of push me pull you of being a professional musician is that if they don't hear about it, they're not going to come. You know, like, I mean, part of my mission has been trying to get the music that I play to more of the Black community, for example, which is what people always ask me. So why are there only white people at your shows? Number one, there aren't only white people at my shows. There are always people of color who come. It's just a very small percentage of the overall whole. And the other thing is that the gatekeepers of like Black culture are not interested in what I'm doing, you know, and this is a complaint I've heard from many, many people of color who do music that's not considered Black. That's not, you know,
what does that mean? What is considered Black now, and who are the gatekeepers that we're talking about?
Like, you know, like hip-hop, R&B, blues, you know, blues, I mean, people know it's Black, but like, you know, and there's Black people who play it, but it's become...
It's a largely white audience.
You know, white sure. audience and white players, yeah. you know, as well. And jazz is one of those, it's kind of like, you know, in that kind of halfway house world, you know, and then opera. You know, there's like been, you know, there's been Black people singing opera and doing classical, writing classical music forever, you know, and it's like we're seen as sort of, you know, interlopers, and so it's very hard. I've talked to other people who have the same thing. I mean, I was talking to Tavis Smiley. I was on his show because Freedom Highway. I started that tour at Sing Sing Prison, and it was the largest Black audience I've ever had, and that just like broke me in several pieces.
What was that like? Know? Tell me about that concert.
I mean, it was very intense, you know, to get like a cultural response that I'm not used to. Because
this is at Sing Sing Prison in Austin, New York, just north of the city.
With the Carnegie Fountain, you know, the Carnegie Hall does this amazing program going in. And we worked with one of the prisoners on one of his songs about domestic violence. I mean, it was really intense. They were beautiful. And you just kind of...
So it wasn't just a performance. You were there for a while.
We did work. Yeah, we were there the whole day, you know. Mm-hmm. And you just look out that sea of brown faces and you think about what does that mean for, you know, when you talk about the incarceration of Black men and men of color and, you know, how the broken the system is. But then from a purely performance point of view, I was just like, the way that they responded to the music was different than when I have, you know, a majority white. I mean, it's kind of hard to explain, like, just the energy that was given back. And I didn't know the personal stories of any of them, didn't want to know, because it's just like, that wasn't the purpose of the visit, you know.
What did you play for them?
We had a full concert. I brought my full band, and we played a lot of stuff from Freedom Highway, and so it's just like I feel very strongly like I'm starting to work with my nephew, who's a 21-year-old rapper, who plays the banjo. right? I taught.
It's an unusual combination.
It is an unusual combination. And he, you know, he's a heavy rapper. Like, this is, he knows hip hop. He knows that world. And this is the way he chooses to express himself.
You're going to record with him?
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to record.
What's his name?
His name's Justin Harrington. Amazing. Demeanor is his handle. But it's just like when you start crossing over into that generation and he sees, he's like, man, when I'm playing this stuff for my friends, they're like, what is that? That's amazing. And I'm like, exactly. It's like when people are exposed to this stuff, they're like, that's so cool. But getting there is the hurdle.
Rhiannon and Francesco, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Rhiannon Giddens, and her new album is called There Is No Other. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Andrew Marantz writes about a lot of heavy stuff for us: politics, the regulation of hate speech on the internet, the rise of the far right in politics. And maybe because of all that, he's also something of an expert on comedy. He'd have to be. Recently, he got together with the comedian Pete Holmes, who created and starred in HBO series Crashing.
I don't know if you can tell by my overall vibe, I am a friendly fellow. Kind of guy that likes to get to the airport a couple hours early, get a few white wines in me, and start telling old people they still got it. That's the kind of...
So I think I first saw Pete Holmes do stand-up like 10 or 12 years ago. And on a bill like that, he stood out. A, he's a big, tall guy. He has referred to himself as looking like a lesbian Val Kilmer. That's his description. But it wasn't just how he looked. He had this kind of wholesome, almost clean comedian vibe.
I don't feel like I belong in comedy. People going out, drinking slippery American cocktails, having sex after. I don't belong in the nightclub scene. Look at me. This face doesn't... How you doing? Fixed your taillight while you were sleeping. No charge. That's... I don't belong in a comedy club. I like to think that there are millions and millions of different universes, each slightly different from the last. And this universe, the one we're all in currently, is the only one where I'm not a youth pastor. Does that resonate with you? I shouldn't be on a fancy...
So Pete actually grew up very strongly evangelical, and he went to a Christian college. He had very strong faith for a lot of the early part of his life. And a lot of what he's written since is about losing that faith. He wrote a HBO show called Crashing that was about losing his faith. He has a book out now called Comedy Sex God that it's not alleging that he is a comedy sex god. It's about comedy, sex, and God. And, you know, this is an unusually earnest subject for a contemporary stand-up comedian. He remains really interested in not only Christianity, but mystical forms of Buddhism and Hinduism. He's now embraced this very kind of all-encompassing curiosity about all types of faith.
Nice to see you.
You too.
Sorry I'm late.
So he was in town recently promoting his book, and he was about to take a red eye back to LA where he lives, and so we decided to just meet up at JFK. There's no part of JFK that's devoted to comedy or sex, but there is actually a God part of JFK. There are these four chapels in Terminal 4, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and Muslim, and just, you know, given his background, Pete was drawn right away to the Protestant one.
Oh, look, the Christ, the cross is an airplane.
Oh, yeah, on the outside, little humor. That's what we're known for. Okay. And then you'll notice the cross is Jesus-less, because that's the Protestant thing.
Right.
The Catholics leave them up there, which the more I study, the more I'm like, I think that's right. It's like,
to
look
leave it
at
up.
The suffering.
Also, it would just be like too on-the-nose Twilight Zone to have Jesus strapped to the plane.
Giant plane-sized Jesus?
Yeah.
That sounds like something. There's like a bar in Japan called Giant Plane-Sized Jesus.
Yeah,
I think we just disturbed that woman with our laughing.
Oh, no. All right, let's do the...
keep walking.
Yeah.
Keep walking.
Sorry. This is the Catholic one, Our Lady of the Skies.
Perfect for an airport.
And
let's go in.
Let's pop in, yeah. We're going very graven image.
Yeah.
This has got to be the most graven of all of them.
You just want to say graven.
No, I remember as a kid being like, I think the first commandment, well, it depends how you do the commandments, but either one or two is make no images of me. But I was like, I feel like people do that a lot.
Right. It's actually one of my favorite Alan Watts quotes. It sort of gets to the heart of that is, I don't want to call these idols, but whenever you have a carved image of God, whether it's Buddha or anybody, that is so easy to make into an idol. But he says the far more dangerous idol are ideas. Not to get too serious right off the bat, but I do think that's what's gone wrong in religion, is a very ego-driven clan mentality. Mm-hmm. I joke in the book that it's like wearing a Patriots sweatshirt or something. You know you belong, and you know your beliefs are right.
Right.
And that gives you that sort of warm, cozy Super Bowl parade feeling. But that's not what it's about. What Alan Watts is saying is that it's about an inner transformation. And I feel like mystics from any tradition would agree with that.
I mean, actually, it's funny because you make a point in the book about not being into sports, but then you do a lot of
sports. I do a lot of sports. Because life is a wonderful little microcosm of life. Because imagine a sport without a clock, that's just life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the sports comparison that I like most in the book, is that when a player who was on the Yankees comes back as a Red Sox, they cheer for him. And even as a kid, I felt something sort of magic, what I would now call third way awareness, both and awareness.
Mm-hmm.
That's Johnny Damon. He is a Yankee and he was a Red Sox player. So we're going to like step outside and appreciate that it's just a person playing
a
game.
So this is what I'm talking about. This stuff is just rattling around in his head all the time. Like we see each other, we walk into the room. Within seconds, he is talking about Christian iconography. He's talking about, you know, the mystic Alan Watts and how a baseball game he went to as a kid is actually an allegory for spirituality. And even the spiritual ramifications of this body swap comedy called Little, like this movie poster that he sees outside his house.
Little. There's so many posters for this movie, Little. But I was like, wow, another body swap comedy. Well, why do we love body swap comedies? It's because even like the least spiritual person in the world deep down has an inkling that who they are is not their packaging,
right,
or what Jung would call, now we're getting real fancy, but you know, what he would call the false self. You're not where you're from. You're not your gender. You're not your country. You're not your likes or your dislikes. You're the thing that I see in my daughter, which is just luminous emptiness. It's just basic, pure awareness. And
so there are times, and Pete is self-aware about this, where this stuff verges on 3 a.m. dorm room kind of conjecture. I get that not everyone has unlimited tolerance for that, and I don't have unlimited tolerance for that. But I think with Pete, this is what he lives with all day. This is what he thinks about. This is what he meditates on. And so even if I wouldn't always end up where he ends up on some of these questions, I do think pursuing the questions is certainly worth doing.
And we can call that mystery God, but you lose so many people when you do. I'm just saying, one of the main points of the book is that we woke up in a conundrum, and our love of certainty has made us have religious viewpoints, certainly, that are far too black and white and in or out and right or wrong. We sometimes lose the idea that, like, none of us know what's going on.
Well, so do you ever think...
I mean, in a beautiful
way. Of course.
I say that with deep respect to both sides. Sorry, we're doing an interview. We're going to leave.
That's
no,
okay.
No. You stay. You stay.
So, yeah. Are you sure?
Yeah. Absolutely.
This is not, this is what it's
this
for.
This is a chapel.
Yeah.
You're welcome, of course. Is this the mosque, I guess?
Yeah.
Mini mosque?
It says Faith Hajj.
It's also closed.
Oh, that, yeah, I think just that door.
Oh, use the adjacent door. See, people yeah. can't even interpret signs on churches the same way.
Exactly.
Well, I feel like we should keep moving.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because we can loiter in front of the Protestant one.
Oh, and I feel like I could, like, go to sleep in the Jewish one. I feel like I could do whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of...
I don't feel chosen enough to go in here.
Oh, I got you. I can cover for you. Yeah.
Different feel.
Yeah. This is kind of a cool... This is more like... Sephardic style, with the round thing in the middle.
Oh.
It's much less graven, right?
It's like less abstract. Graven, but to me, these symbols, because I wasn't raised with them, feel like they don't want me. No disrespect to my Catholic friends, but it feels a little bit more like I can say balls in here.
Mm-hmm. I think you have to. As he goes on about this stuff, you can sometimes forget that he is still a comedian. But I do think it's really intimately connected, his impulse to kind of bring people together around questions of the mysteries of the universe. For him, it's very relatable to the impulse to get on a stage and make people laugh. I think he thinks of them as the same kind of thing that really animates all of his thinking. Because one thing that occurs to me is that there seems to be a wave of people in comedy, you being one of them, who want to, like, no, I want to do things in a way that isn't injuring people and is like respectful to the world. And
right.
Because there's this old attitude that I heard being expressed a lot more in the past that was, fuck them if they can't take a joke. And like, what it is to do comedy is to flout social rules and to be the bad guy and the rebel. And so like, by definition, if I'm making you cringe, I'm on the right side. And now I see you and all these people who talk openly about like how to not injure the world, how to be more sustaining of things.
It's tricky because, like, I do defend people's rights to make ugly jokes. Because, again, I have a hang-up for getting attached to our own purity. So it's always a good idea, in my experience, to sit in the middle. Like, let's look to the future. I have a lot of content out there. Is there a world where somebody finds something modern-day 2034 unwoke that I said on my talk show and I can't host the 97th annual Oscars? Right. Or I'm sure there's more than that. Yeah, probably. Yeah. So what are we going to do? I just think it's really, really helpful to sit in the middle with everything. Is the Bible true or is it a myth? Well, yeah, sure. Is there a God or is there nothing? Yeah. Are we human or are we souls? Uh-huh. It's so liberating. It doesn't get many clicks.
None.
And that's okay. Not going for clicks.
Pete Holmes' new book is called Comedy, Sex, God. He visited Interfaith Alley at Kennedy Airport with the New Yorker's Andrew Marantz. And they stopped by all four places of worship there. Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, and Muslim.
I'd like to think that the exclusion of Eastern faiths were not sad, but because they asked them and they were like, we're good. I think you have what now? Four rooms?
All right.
Hope that's working out for you.
I'm David Remnick, and that's it for now. Join us next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, and until then, have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.